You're listening to an event from the U.S. Institute of Peace, part of the USIP podcast network. For more information about our work around the world, visit usip.org and check us out on social media.
Welcome to USIP. My name is Andrew Wilder. I'm the Vice President of the Asia Center here at USIP. This is our 40th anniversary year at USIP. We were founded in 1984. By the U.S. Congress as an independent, nonpartisan public institution with a mission to prevent, mitigate, and resolve violent conflict abroad. We're really honored to have this opportunity today to launch an important new USIP Senior Study Group report examining transnational crime in Southeast Asia, which is a growing threat to the safety and security of people and all over the globe, including here in the United States. It's a privilege to welcome Mr. Brandon Yoder, Deputy Assistant Secretary in the State Department's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement. INL has been a critical partner in USIP's work on this issue, as well as other issues, and we're grateful for their support. I'd also like to welcome other panelists joining us today. Jason Tower is our country director in Burma, who's just arrived last night from Bangkok, where he's currently based. Aaron West, a deputy district attorney in the Office of the District Attorney in Santa Clara, welcome. Jacob Sims, a visiting expert with USIP, and our moderator for today's conversation will be Nicole Cochran, a program officer with USIP's Burma program. Although transnational criminal networks have operated in the Southeast Asia region since the early 2000s, their influence has expanded and deepened exponentially in recent years. The pandemic and the policies of governments in and outside the region have fundamentally altered the practices of these networks in unimaginable ways. Forced labor compounds have sprung up throughout Southeast Asia. Their operators use sophisticated technology to traffic victims from around the world into compounds where they are threatened with torture and abuse if they don't trick others with various online scams. USIP first began investigating these nascent enclaves in Burma 2 years before the 2021 military coup. Since then, the military junta and its aligned forces have created an enabling environment for these enclaves to grow at a rapid pace, while existing criminal networks have further entrenched themselves in several Mekong countries. No ASEAN country is unaffected by this crisis, and the tentacles of these criminal actors have reached as far as China, Nigeria, Brazil, and the United States. Today, we'll hear from several experts at the leading edge of this crisis who will explain this phenomenon, the risks to ordinary citizens, the role of regional powers in shaping and addressing the problem, and how governments are responding. So thanks once again for coming today. Deputy Assistant Secretary Yoder, with that, I'll turn it over to you, invite you to the podium for your opening remarks. Thank you.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Andrew, for the introduction, and thank you to USIP for putting this event together today. It's a pleasure to join you all on behalf of the Department of State and the Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, or INL. Today, we're marking the launch of USIP's new report on transnational crime in Southeastern Asia, an initiative that INL was pleased to support. From illicit drug production and trafficking to kleptocracy and money laundering, we know that transnational crime fuels global instability. It erodes democracy, and it undercuts economic growth and investment. INL's mission is to help partner governments in the fight against crime and corruption, to strengthen criminal justice institutions around the world, and to bolster the rule of law. INL's efforts improve living conditions for citizens in the countries we assist and enhance security and prosperity for Americans. Now, before we turn to USIP's report, which puts a much-needed spotlight on the criminal scamming compounds in Southeast Asia, I want to review a few transnational crime trends in the region. According to the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, we now know that Burma is the world's number one producer of both methamphetamine and opium poppy, creating a major crisis not only for the people of Burma, but for every country in which these drugs are trafficked and consumed. Using precursor chemicals sourced primarily from the People's Republic of China, criminal groups are taking advantage of Burma's instability and extremely porous borders to manufacture and traffic drugs across Asia, Oceania, and beyond. We also know that precursor chemicals from the PRC are used to make another highly lethal synthetic drug that is fueling the overdose epidemic here in the United States. I'm, of course, referring to fentanyl. Here in the United States, we felt the acute effects of the production and trafficking of illicit fentanyl. In 2022, nearly 110,000 Americans died of drug overdoses, a record number, and approximately two-thirds of those involved synthetic drugs and opioids. That's why President Biden and Secretary Blinken have made clear that addressing the synthetic drug threat at home and abroad is a top national security priority. Last July, Secretary Blinken launched the Global Coalition to Address Synthetic Drug Threats. We now have more than 150 countries, including 9 Southeast Asian countries, committed to countering this global problem. Participants in the coalition are working together to share best practices on preventing the illicit manufacturing and trafficking of synthetic drugs, detecting emerging threats, and promoting public health interventions. The Biden administration is committed to tackling the source of the U.S. epidemic, overdose epidemic, and supporting our partners in Southeast Asia and around the world to combat the threat of illicit synthetic drugs. Turning to today's report, in groundbreaking research, USIP has documented how Southeast Asia has become a breeding ground for transnational criminal networks. These networks, many originating from or linked to the PRC, are unleashing a new wave of criminality on the world. In recent years, we've seen the rise of sophisticated illegal scam centers in Southeast Asia, particularly Burma, Laos, and Cambodia. These scam centers are run by criminal networks, rely on human trafficking and forced labor, and steal vast amounts of money from their victims. In a major finding, USIP's research team calculates that the criminal syndicates running these scam centers likely reap more than $43 billion a year in illicit profit. That's right. They steal more than $43 billion annually from their victims. This estimate represents nearly 40% of the GDP of Laos, Cambodia, and Burma combined. These scam compounds in Southeastern Asia form the epicenter of an illicit global industry. So let me run you through how they work. And to the fans of Last Week Tonight, I'm going to apologize in advance that my presentation won't rival John Oliver's, who documented the magnitude of this problem in a recent episode of his show. Now, the first victims of the scam centers are the individuals lured to the compounds by the prospects of lucrative employment, often advertised as tech industry jobs, only to be duped and kidnapped. They are subjected to debt bondage, sexual exploitation, and even torture, and then forced to carry out these criminal schemes. Now, these individuals are often male, educated, with tech skills and foreign language abilities, commonly English. They do not present as typical victims of trafficking or forced labor, making the screening and identification of them all the more difficult. Now, as they engage in forced criminality, these trafficking victims adopt fake identities and then use text messages to gain the trust of their targets. They often use the illusion of a romantic or intimate partnership or relationship to manipulate their targets and then persuade them to invest in fraudulent schemes, frequently involving cryptocurrency or fake businesses. USIP estimates that there are more than 300,000 trafficking victims from over 60 countries being held in scam compounds in Southeast Asia. Now, that's roughly the population of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, or St. Paul, Minnesota, a staggering number. The second group of victims of these operations are the targets of the scams. Now, while the earliest victims of the scam centers were largely from China, U.S. citizens have been increasingly become a major target of Southeastern Asia's scamming industry. I think it's safe to say we have all received some version of their text messages. Some are easy to spot, riddled with typos, often offering unbelievable job or investment opportunities. But what about that text message that might be a little more harder to discern? A random good afternoon from an unknown number? Or what about, hey, is this Kelly's number? It's Sophia. This last one is real and one that our colleagues received just this past weekend. Would you respond? It's easy to think that you wouldn't be fooled by this or more elaborate schemes. And yet the numbers tell a much different story. In 2023, U.S. citizens lost an estimated $3.5 billion to these criminal schemes. And this tragic number is likely an underestimate due to underreporting by the victims. Here in the United States, these scams have a direct impact on U.S. citizens' livelihoods. This money is hard-earned income, It could be a grandmother's retirement money, a father's college saving fund for his kids, or maybe your brother and his significant other's down payment on their house. These scams hit hard. Now, there's one other element of these scam centers that I haven't touched on yet. How some ruling elites in Southeast Asia have a vested interest in protecting the scam industry. USIP's new report highlights how certain elites in Burma, Cambodia, and other countries in the region profit directly from these scam centers, and in some cases, own the compounds. Additionally, I need to underscore that these scam centers fuel money laundering globally, and use complex operations to move illicit profits into the formal economy through casinos, real estate, or financial technologies like cryptocurrency. In sum, Southeast Asian scam centers pose multifaceted challenges, and combating this growing threat will require improved international coordination to counter criminal groups' abilities to operate across borders, outrun law enforcement, and wield corruption to ensure that they can operate with impunity. The Biden administration has made it clear that the fight against corruption and transnational crime, including the growing threat posed by these scam operations and the impact that they have on the American people, is a national security priority. And this is why INL is working with partners across Southeast Asia, including law enforcement, judges, and prosecutors, to build their capacity to investigate, prosecute, and bring to justice individuals who commit these crimes. From Thailand to the Philippines, and from Vietnam to Indonesia, we're supporting partner governments with the training and equipment they need in order to detect, deter, and investigate crime. This includes supporting our partners in advanced investigation techniques that go beyond arresting low-level criminals to investigate and uncover the sophisticated networks behind them. I look forward to today's presentations and to panelists unpacking the findings in USIP's report. This kind of research and analysis is critical to enabling international coordination. And by putting a spotlight on these troubling trends, we may be able to spur some additional actions as well. The United States remains committed to our partners in Southeast Asia and supporting their efforts to disrupt, dismantle, and deter transnational organized crime, including these online scam operations. And so with that, I just want to thank USIP again for its report. I think it's critical to the debate that we're going to continue having about this issue and critical to spotlighting the very real impact this has on our fellow citizens. So I look forward to the conversation. And once again, thank you all.
All right. Yes, please. thank you so much, Deputy Assistant Secretary Yoder, for being here with us today and for INL's really strong support of this effort. And thanks to my Vice President Andrew Wilder as well for the introductions. As he mentioned, I'm Nicole Cochran. I'm a program officer here supporting this great work. And to my right, or your left, I suppose, we have Jason Tower, Jacob Sims, and Aaron West. These panelists are three of nine study group members who, for the past 6 months, have given USIP their time and expertise to help us understand this phenomenon that's taking place in Southeast Asia, but is affecting people all over the world, including here in the United States. Before we start the conversation, I just want to say to our viewers online, you'll notice that there is a chat box in which you can write questions. We'll be monitoring that chat box. And for folks in the room, when we reach the Q&A, we will have microphone runners who will come around. If you could please wait until you have a microphone in hand to ask your question so that our online audience can hear you, we'd greatly appreciate it. So Deputy Assistant Secretary Yoder briefly outlined some of the issues and the findings of this report. But Jason, I'd like to ask you to elaborate on this issue and put into context for us the problem that we're facing.
Great, thank you, Nicole. And it's great to have the opportunity together with some of the other members of our senior study group to launch the report here today. I guess turning to the question, USIP got involved initially in researching these issues back in late 2019, early 2020, and Part of the motivation was that you saw at the time that there was a very significant incursion of Chinese origin crime groups into Myanmar, particularly into the Thailand-Myanmar border area. Many of the Chinese origin crime groups had been involved in the Philippines or in Cambodia in illegal online gambling. And what they were doing was partnering with a armed group in Myanmar, actually directly under the Myanmar military, to create a new enclave to engage in illegal online gambling in that part of Myanmar, and then also to bring with it all of the other types of illicit activities that are associated with the Chinese online illegal gambling market, which is estimated at somewhere in the range of 40 to 80 billion US dollars per year. So at the time, USIP was particularly concerned about the implications for conflict, the implications for peace and security in Myanmar of these issues. And we began to look at, you know, kind of how some of these dynamics were factoring into the, both in Myanmar, into efforts towards reform, towards democracy, as well as more regionally, you know, what this would mean in terms of implications for human security. We found through this process that there was actually a strong desire by the part of the then NLD civilian government to try to crack down on and deal with this activity. But a military coup in 2021 resulted in a very significant escalation in the activity and spread of the activity, as well as a shift in terms of what a lot of the Chinese origin criminal networks were doing in terms of the types of crimes that were happening in enclaves like those that became very deeply embedded on the Myanmar-Thai borderlands. So they went from an earlier emphasis on online gambling to these forms of sophisticated scams, pig butchering scams. And they went from targeting largely a market in China to targeting a global market, which is increasingly is focused on the United States. According to US authorities, were one of the number one targets at this point. So USIP, I guess, around this had been looking at these issues for a few years, and we got the idea to establish this senior study group to look more comprehensively at the overall development of the problems with these so-called sophisticated or pig butchering scams, as they're referred to, so long types of cons that involve building trust with a victim before introducing some type of a fraudulent investment opportunity, often on cryptocurrency. That's what you tend to see in these scams. The group looked at this from a wide range of angles in terms of how the criminal networks are laundering money, how they're at really the cutting edge of technology, which is incorporated into the methodologies that they use to scam people, the methodologies that they use to traffic or trick people into the enclaves. And then we also looked at a lot of the gaps that are there present in terms of the way that law enforcement is responding, in terms of the way that elites have been captured in the region. And I guess, you know, some of the high-level conclusions of the report are that this is really a problem that needs a whole-of-government approach as its solution. So, I mean, this has gone, you know, going back just 4 or 5 years ago when we started looking at these issues, this has gone from being very much a regional issue that was focused on, you know, kind of criminal markets within the region, to a global issue in a very short period of time. And it's spreading. It's spreading into other countries. So in the process of conducting the research, we also identified that, you know, there's new linkages into the Middle East, into Africa, that these same criminal actors are beginning to exploit. And you're seeing this type of activity spread to those jurisdictions and to target people from the US and from other countries around the world from those jurisdictions as well. So I think that gives you kind of an overview of some of the issues, as well as some of the different policy recommendations in the report.
Yeah. So it's a really multifaceted problem that touches on more traditional security threats, like conflict in the case of Myanmar, but also some non-traditional security threats. And two of the major threats to the public are human trafficking and then these fraud scams. So turning to you, Jake, as an expert in human trafficking and labor exploitation, can you tell us more about the trends that we're seeing in the region? Who is being trafficked? How are they being trafficked? And some of the enabling factors?
Thanks, Nicole. Thank you, USIP, for hosting this event. It's an honor to be here and to be involved in this research. In terms of victims, I'll start by saying labor trafficking has long followed a pretty well-established pattern in the region. It's historically impacted rural, very low education, people who are very vulnerable, and almost entirely emanating from very fragile countries in the region. It's low-wage workers that are migrating en masse to the major regional economies. They get exploited, find minimal protection under rule of law. That's the dominant paradigm. But this phenomenon has flipped that dynamic entirely. And the victims of forced scamming are tech-savvy, multilingual, very urban. They were likely made vulnerable, yes, by COVID-19-related economic contractions, but they're also very well educated. They're many of them previously held professional jobs, stable jobs, and they're not leaving from the fragile countries, they're going to the fragile countries, and they're going at a rate and a scale that we've never seen before. As Deputy Assistant Secretary Yoder said a minute ago, this report builds on prior estimates to suggest the labor force exceeds 300,000 people. Just re-emphasize how huge that number is, and emanating from over 40 countries from around the world. And while clearly not all of those people have been validated as trafficking victims, reports of human trafficking, reports of violent labor abuse are widespread, rampant in this space, and highly verified as well. The mode of trafficking, as you suggested, has also shifted significantly. These folks aren't being recruited by local brokers in their community anymore. This is all happening on social media. So your typical victim likely responded to a job post on Facebook. They went through a legitimate seeming recruitment process. They flew to Thailand or Cambodia, probably paid for by the employer, or picked up at the airport, driven to the place of business. But instead of going to an office or a business complex, they were taken to a militarized compound that was probably owned by perhaps an SAC-affiliated warlord in Myanmar, a very powerful oligarch in Cambodia, maybe an investor in an SEZ in Laos. So to answer the question, who are the traffickers? This is a large, geographically diffuse network with lots of players. But at the end of the day, it's those people. It's the warlord, the oligarch, the criminal investor, and critically, the complicit government officials that are enabling this across those three countries. Because at the end of the day, it's the people who are sitting on top of this massive industry that when we're looking at accountability, who's culpable for the abuses happening inside, those are the people that we need to be thinking about. But when the victims arrive at these compounds, they have their passports taken, and they are forced to conduct criminal activities under the threat of violence. And again, because of the level of influence of their captors and the people who own these places, they very frequently find that their prospects for rescue or escape are quite limited. So in terms of response, there are some very significant constraints here, but that looks different in each of these contexts. And in Myanmar, almost the entire response is driven from the Thai side of the border, where you have the vast majority of the burden of the rescue response is being shouldered today by a very small number of locally based actors. And these folks are looking at and negotiating with embassies, but they're also taking on significant risks in dialogues with rebel groups and local power brokers, even the criminal groups themselves, just to try to get people out of compounds and help them. And there's also an emerging effort amongst more established organizations that are working in collaboration with the Thai government to screen for victims, to ensure more systematic post-victim rescues care, and also pursue other policy reforms from the Thai side. And while the industry in Myanmar is thriving in these areas of contested sovereignty, you look at Laos, and it's actually these exist in special economic zones where the government has effectively ceded sovereignty to the criminal enterprises. And that complicates response in different ways, but similar to Myanmar, the effort is quite small, it's underfunded, it's grassroots-led, and it's principally victim care-focused. Now, Cambodia's landscape has its own distinctives. In Cambodia, it's not instability, and it's not SEZs that are providing the protection here, but it's the all-encompassing way in which gambling-adjacent criminals have been able to effectively co-opt the state apparatus. So in Cambodia, these compounds exist all over the country. There are hundreds of identified compounds, and in general, they're owned by Cambodian ruling party politicians or other elite actors that have positions of influence. And that actually includes compounds that are owned by direct advisors to or even family members of the sitting prime minister. So endemic top-to-bottom state involvement in a criminal industry like this clearly poses its own set of unique challenges. And in Cambodia, unfortunately, this has taken the mode of a directly antagonistic posture by the government to the victims themselves. So you have top counter-trafficking officials frequently referring to victims of this crime broadly as liars, attention seekers, other terms of abuse that are designed and have the impact of undermining victim testimony. Cambodian government has also taken documented repressive actions against victim relief efforts. For over 2 years, you have rescue activists being imprisoned, media reporting on the issue shuttered or kicked out of the country, and reports from NGOs working in the space receiving intimidation, harassment, et cetera. So there's a whole lot more that I could say about response constraints, but notably, I have not mentioned much about a law enforcement response. And the reason for that is that up to this point, we have not seen an effective, locally derived law enforcement response from these countries. Plenty of promises, lots of statements of commitment, a few scattered PR-oriented crackdown type efforts going on, but nothing which has actually effectively undermined the industry or been disruptive. And again, instability in some contexts, state involvement in the other being the prime drivers of that status quo. But in closing, I'll say if we really want to disrupt this industry, we're going to need to look at ways to counter those domestic incentives and shift the conversation more towards how do we hold high-level perpetrators accountable. And sort of given this presentation, I think for obvious reasons, that effort probably has to start from abroad. And so that means that concerning global governments are going to need to close some of the law enforcement gaps that exist. And the way this is being currently pursued, it means strengthened law enforcement collaboration. It means more creativity in how we target criminals across jurisdictions, across crime types. It also means a movement towards a more strategic, coordinated sanctioning regime so that we can find additional ways to target the key perpetrators and the government officials who are complicit in this. So those are some sort of initial recommendations for response. The report offers a host of others, and I would suggest please do read it, because as Jason said, this is due to the mounting global costs here, this is an issue that really demands a coordinated global response, and my hope is that this report can be a catalyst for that response. So look forward to continuing the conversation, and thank you so much again, USIP, for having me.
Thanks. So I think two things stuck out to me about your points, one being the role of technology and social media in helping to facilitate trafficking, which I know is also an issue that Erin here cares a lot about and can speak to from the cyber scamming side. But really quick before we turn to that issue, I think something else that comes up is the regional nature of how these networks are integrated. And just want to offer an opportunity to reflect on that.
Oh, back to me.
Or you or Jason or Erin.
Sure, yes. I mean, there's a lot we could say about how these different groups are moving between and have relationships between Cambodia, Myanmar, Laos, back to China as well. It's a defining part of this. And that's another reason when you look at what should a response look like, it can't be completely locally led. And it also has to look like a collaborative regional and global law enforcement response.
Maybe just to add very quickly, one trend that we've seen is, I mean, and just this goes back also more historically when these criminal networks were focused more on illicit online gambling, but you'd have these intermittent crackdowns which might focus on, say, the Philippines, and then they would move to Cambodia, which is what happened kind of in the mid-2010s, and then where they then moved from Cambodia to the Thai-Myanmar borderlands in 2019 after a crackdown, and then in 2022, there was a half-hearted crackdown in Cambodia that sent some of them into Myanmar, which picked up quite a few. You know, you saw major growth in a lot of the compounds at that point in time in that country. And then most recently, there's been a crackdown in the China-Myanmar border area, which seems to have more systematically disrupted some of those compounds, and even some of the compound owners have been actually taken by Chinese authorities, either through formal processes where arrest warrants were issued, or what would appear to be covert operations where some of the perpetrators were invited to China then to be kidnapped or arrested on arrival. But what that led to was many of these compounds then moving once again to the Thai-Myanmar border or back into Cambodia. So you could sort of see where these country-by-country types of approaches or these campaign-style approaches are very easily defeated by the criminal networks, who have so many different hubs that they can operate in and have the ability to kind of move their operations back and forth quite seamlessly across countries.
And has resulted in almost every case not in even displacement, but actually just net growth across all of these countries.
Absolutely. And as you all have noted, these networks are incredibly dynamic. They've shifted the way that they operate from online gambling to cyber scamming. So Aaron, you're kind of on the leading edge of law enforcement responses to this, having seen many victims here in the US. Can you tell us a bit more about what these scams look like, how people get caught up in them, and why they're so dangerous?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me today, and thank you so much for asking me to be a part of this really important paper that I too hope will be a catalyst. I hope that we've documented the problem, and we are talking about it in such volume that you will understand the massive problem that we're facing. So thank you so much for having me. I'm a Santa Clara County prosecutor. I'm a local prosecutor who sees what happens to victims at the ground level. And starting in March 2022, we got our first victim. And our first victim was a 30-year-old software engineer, male. And so a lot of people I think that there's just a kind of a knowledge gap generally in the United States about what these scams are and who they're happening to. I think oftentimes we want to make this a senior issue, but in fact, it is hitting literally every demographic. Anybody that has a phone is a potential victim. And what we saw was this gentleman coming to reporting to local law enforcement, and local law enforcement saying, well, there's nothing we can do about this. And then ultimately, I'm fortunate enough to work in a high-tech task force of local detectives. And we thought, well, you know what, let's give this a shot. This is a victim who needs help. And we do know how to trace cryptocurrency. That's what we do. So the nature of these crimes as they are appearing in the United States is pig butchering doesn't end until our victims have lost literally every penny they have. They liquidate their children's college funds. They liquidate their retirement accounts. And the game is not over until all of that is in the hands of the scammers. And then the scammers say, well, if you want to take any of this money out, you're going to need to pay taxes, and it's 25%. And our victims think, oh my God, okay, we'll take that out of my gains. And they say, no, it has to be new money. And that's when our victims are literally getting mortgages, additional mortgages on their houses. They're taking high interest loans. They're begging and borrowing from people. And then what they're finding is that, oh my God, my money is gone. But not only that, this person that I fell in love with and trusted is actually in on it. And then P.S., they're actually a victim too, and they're being trafficked and forced to do this dirty work. And then in my 25 years of being a prosecutor, I have never seen the devastation in victims that I am seeing. I am having grown men cry to me on the phone routinely. I am having people just absolutely distraught. I'm familiar with suicides. I'm familiar with attempted suicides. The magnitude of this is massive. And I think when I first started talking about this 2 years ago, I was often sort of given the brush off of, oh, this is a romance scam. We know about romance scams. We're good. We don't need your help. We don't need to know more about this. And I had a very difficult time getting people to listen to what this problem was. And meanwhile, I'm on the phone all day, every day with people who are literally at the lowest point of their life. So I want to tell you a little bit about what this looks like as an American victim. They will be contacted, just as you mentioned, by a random text message. And one of my favorite images is I finally got our chief detective at our task force to watch the John Oliver special, which if you haven't watched, you should probably go right now and watch it and then come back. It's that good. But he's watching it, and as he's watching it, he gets one of those texts. And so he takes a picture of his phone up with John Oliver behind him. That's how ubiquitous this is. It's everywhere. I never, ever talk to a group where people don't all recognize that they are getting these texts, but what they don't recognize is where it's coming from and that it's probably coming from someone who's imprisoned. So it's coming from those texts, but also it's coming from three other really big contributors to this, and that's Meta, it's LinkedIn, and it's Match.com. And I really look forward to collaboration with them about what can be done about this, because when we look at the life scan of how these are operating, that's the meeting point. And from there, we know how it works, and now we're talking to banks to see what can be done from banks and what we can be done from the crypto institutions and what can be done from local law enforcement, federal, what we're doing with our international partners, and how we look at this as an international problem. And that's why I work with this group, because that's their expertise. My expertise is the very victims that are literally losing their mind every day and demanding help. And if I could just say one more thing about what that looks like, what they're finding is that when they arrive at their local law enforcement, they are shamed, they are made to feel stupid, they are turned away. I just had another law enforcement agency reach out to me and say, our office is anti-crypto. We're not going to take any of these cases. You're anti-crypto. Okay. Are you anti-cars and you're not handling car theft? Like it doesn't make any sense, but that's what we're seeing and that's where we are. And so so I started a group of local law enforcement, and it's grown. It's up to 1,600 members of local, state, federal, and international law enforcement that we are actively training every day on how to help victims of this. But it's clear, especially after listening to all three of us, that I always say, I was able to recover some money for some victims, for 25 victims, and that's fantastic, but I always equate it to throwing eggs at a skyscraper. Like that's great for my victims, but that is not doing anything about a major problem that when you read the report, you'll see quite clearly is state-sponsored and promoted by oligarchs in their countries. How do we, as a unit, fix that? And I love that this report gives plenty of concrete ideas about how to do it. And I too have my own ideas about what we need to do, particularly in the United States with law enforcement. It is a travesty that we are not taking this on with a federal task force that is handling parts of this, and locals are handling the parts they can handle. This needs to be handled globally. We have people in silos that have pieces of information. I convened a group of law enforcement, and one was talking about, well, I can identify this domain, and somebody else said, well, and I can trace it to this wallet, and somebody else on the call said, well, I'm on the ground in Southeast Asia, and I know who's contributing to that wallet as ransom payments. And then somebody else on the call was talking about what information they have about that compound. This is knowable and doable. The information is out there and it's siloed. And I am a big proponent of, I think we can arrest our way out of this. I think that we need to make an attempt at arresting our way out of this. People need to be held accountable for this, and it's doable and knowable. So that's where I'm faced, and I am so blessed to have such genius colleagues, these three and the other six that were part of the report, who are such specialists in their areas.
Thanks, Erin, for the reminder of the human element of this and the need for empathy. This is a very systemic problem, and it's truly remarkable and disturbing how sophisticated these operations are, but they're having a very personal impact. Now, American citizens are not the only victims of these scams by far. People from all over the world are being targeted, even in Southeast Asia. And people in China have also been severely victimized by these scams. But the report notes the complex role of China in this issue. So Jason, I was wondering if you could elaborate on that. What is China's interest in this issue, and why does that matter?
Sure, yeah. So there's a whole section of the report that talks about the different roles that China plays in all of this. I think the first thing to point out is that these criminal networks became so powerful and got so deeply embedded in Southeast Asia, both as they were chased out of China, but then also as for many years, not only did you have Chinese authorities looking the other way as they grew in power and influence across the region, you also had many Chinese state-owned enterprises, many different parts of the Chinese state, different Chinese quasi-governmental associations, party associations that actually actively benefited from a lot of the precursors of this criminal activity. So from the casino cities. And I think the report goes into quite some detail on one of the cases along the Thai-Myanmar border, where you had this giant casino city that was built with funds, largely illicit funds that were earned by online gambling syndicates in the Philippines and Cambodia. This infrastructure was built in cooperation with one of China's state-owned enterprises. So a Chinese state-owned company actually was awarded a multi-hundred million dollar contract to build this infrastructure. And I think that that's one of the common patterns that you see is where these criminal actors became more powerful in the region because of the relationships that they had with the PRC and what they had with different elements of the Chinese Communist Party. And there's a series of cases in the report that show this aspect of things. Now, I think there's another element of this in terms of China's role as a victim, right? So you have many Chinese people that have been victimized by both the illegal online gambling and by the same scams. And that includes large numbers of Chinese trafficking victims that were trafficked after China reopened from COVID-19, that were trafficked across the China border. You have very large numbers, similarly, of Chinese victims. And in fact, one of the statistics that we came across, which is a PRC official number, was that there have been in 2023 in the range of over $40 billion of intercepted cases of online scams in China, many of them initiating from Southeast Asia. I mean, that is massive, right? The amount of scams that are still targeting Chinese nationals. And then the third element of this is, of course, more recently how you've seen China link this around some of its own political initiatives. And in particular, you've seen where since August of 2023, at a very high level, at the Politburo level, the Chinese Communist Party has been pushing to crack down on these online scams in a more significant way. But tying that to China's global security initiative, which also seeks to revise global security norms, which is actually quite threatening to the current system of alliances and really many of the ways in which security partnerships that the U.S. has built out over many decades are directly being threatened by this new security initiative. So you're seeing Chinese police, as they're going into Myanmar and cracking down on some of these scam syndicates, they're talking about this as an element of how China is contributing more security goods overseas. And so in that sense, something which is really more of a human security issue, more of a law enforcement issue, is being politicized in that, China first and foremost is trying to help its own nationals. But then if it wants to, if other countries want to get some form of assistance from Chinese police in cracking down on some of this activity, the Chinese side is looking for them to, kind of make some sort of commitments around the global security initiative or framework. So this is a third way in which the Chinese law enforcement response is politicizing this issue or linking this issue to some of the PRC's these broader international agendas and initiatives around the world.
At this point, I'd like to see if we have any questions from the audience. All right, we'll start with the woman over there in the blue. Once your mic will be coming your way very shortly.
Hi, I'm Kelly Curry. I actually wanted to follow up on that specific point. One of the things that has, and Jason and I have had many conversations about this issue over the years, and until Chinese victims, until China started having substantial victims of these crimes, I would say in the post-COVID period, until it started to be a problem for China, I think it was very clear that they were very happy to offload their criminals onto other jurisdictions and then extract material benefits for themselves. And now that it's a problem for them because their citizens are affected negatively, they're all interested in doing something and even allowing it to be talked about. Even the UN has changed its willingness to, first they didn't want to talk about this, so talk about China's role in it, and now they're much more willing to talk about the problem. It's still not attributed to an official party state role, but and so if you could just talk a little bit more about how how China is, why and how countries that are trying to solve this problem can push back on this tendency that Beijing has, that even if they have a problem, they're still going to try to extract some concession from other partners in order to work together to solve it.
You know, I think that's a really good question. I think on the first part of this, I would completely agree that, you have so many instances where these criminal networks, they actually will take their criminal activity and paper them over with China's Belt and Road Initiative and build active cooperation with China around BRI on what should otherwise be, even according to China's own laws, something that's illegal for certainly Chinese state-owned enterprises. But again, going back to some of the overseas casino cities, it's also illegal for Chinese citizens to be investing in casinos overseas. So there's, I think, a lot of evidence that you can point to support those claims. I'd also agree that the shift in kind of the Chinese government's perspective on this issue did relate very much to the fact that this became an issue of social stability in China, right? I mean, you have literally towns and villages where in one very concentrated area, you have thousands of victims of one of these different forms of schemes. And then you started to have street protests. And so in that respect, this became something that was seen as a threat to local government agencies, local government offices, because they started seeing instability come as a result of some of this. And I think that prompted a much stronger desire to start cracking down on these things because they did have that domestic impact. There was, I think, growing levels of instability triggered by some of this activity. But then when it comes to kind of the global role that China is playing, I think in some senses, if you look at this, when China started to crack down on these criminal syndicates going after Chinese nationals, that is in many ways what pushed them to start shifting their targets and to focus more on American victims, focus more on other international victims. And now you don't really see where the Chinese police are expressing a strong interest in doing anything to crack down on those who are scamming people from other countries. So, I mean, I think in that regard, there are some comparisons here with the fentanyl crisis in that, you have an issue that is, related to China, a problem that's related to China. China has certainly a role here. There are Chinese criminal agencies and actors involved in this, but the problem is harming a third country. And so you don't really have, I think, a very strong interest on the part of the Chinese government to get involved, unless there's some way that makes it more amenable or beneficial to the Chinese side. So I think one important thing here is also around the framing of some of these issues, right? I mean, just as the US is a victim, many other countries in Southeast Asia, countries across Europe, across the whole world are victims of a form of activity that is being perpetrated by criminal actors that are largely from China. They're using methodologies that they perfected, you know, trying out first on a Chinese population, and now they're bringing those methodologies elsewhere. So in some senses, I think there's a lot of tools that should be there in China, a lot of knowledge and understanding that should be there in China. And I think if some of the countries that are being impacted by this activity raise that issue, including the U.S., I should think it's important also for the U.S. to raise this issue with China. You know, there needs to be some accountability, some responsibility for this, given the way in which all of this evolved, and given, you know, even the fact that there was very direct involvement of Chinese state actors in enabling these criminal groups to become so powerful in the first place.
Great. I have another question back there.
Brian Eiler from the Stimson Center. Kind of a follow-up to your question, Kelly, and Jason's comments, and you've kind of already answered it, but I've always thought that this is China's problem to solve, at least to dedicate significant resources to address and to clean up the problem. Even though victims might not be Chinese as much as before, I think it's still happening in a robust amount. But given that the criminals are, many of them are Chinese nationals operating abroad. And Jason, again, you kind of answered the question, but I'm curious as to the institutions, the specific institutions you see coming together in Beijing and at subnational levels to address this issue, what resources you might be seeing coming together to address it, so that we can better understand, you know, a specific way that Beijing is addressing this issue, and therefore we know the rest of the playing field in which to engage or how to engage with Beijing.
I guess that's that question. I'll respond briefly. So I mean, at the highest levels, it's been the Central Political Legal Affairs Commission of the Chinese Communist Party. That's the highest level body, which started to have fairly frequent meetings. I mean, I think since August, there's been two or three instances where that very high-level committee, and even the there's a Politburo member, Chen Wenqing, has actually put attention to this issue. So I think that sends a signal that there is much higher level. This has all been since 2023, much higher level attention to this from China. Of course, you have Chinese courts that are very active. Chinese police are very active. There's an online app, which is actually also quite controversial, because some local governments are requiring people to install this app on their phone, which apparently it gives all sorts of data to the Chinese government once you've installed it. But what this app does is it triggers any, you know, kind of potential scamming activity. It will send messages, warnings, block that activity on a phone. So, I mean, there are resources, I think, being allocated in this way to try to, you know, prevent Chinese citizens from becoming victims of some of this activity. I guess then in terms of what that role for all of this might be when looking at this problem more globally, I think there's really two quick points here. One is that I think this problem is much, much bigger than at this point than China could possibly tackle, because what has happened is that many other criminal groups around the world have found just how lucrative this form of scamming is. And so from Vietnam to Nigeria, and I think Aaron, in fact, you were the one who told me first about the Nigeria one, so maybe you could speak more about that one. But, you know, there's other criminal groups that are adopting the methodologies, particularly in Vietnam. I was there a few weeks ago and learned a little bit about this, but other criminal groups are starting to adopt these methodologies and deploy them on other populations in other language sets. And so you could sort of see where this is kind of a way in which, you know, these criminal networks are sharing information, they're adapting, they're learning from one another. So this makes it very much, you know, a problem that needs a global response. I guess, you know, the role of different actors, China could be supplying a lot more information to the rest of the world about all of these different scams. Most of what I just shared about the app and other sorts of things, there's all sorts of ways in which the Chinese government are sending out text messages and information and police campaigns. I mean, most of that is in Chinese. It's not shared with other countries. There's also very large amounts of intel now, given that you've had around close to 50,000 Chinese who've been brought back from outside of China. And they have lots of intelligence on, you know, how funds are being stolen, whose funds are being stolen, and to my knowledge, that information is not being shared elsewhere. So those are perhaps some very low-lying fruit in terms of the, you know, forms of coordination. Just simply getting that intelligence sharing going on some of these issues could be quite helpful.
Just to add an additional opportunity maybe for dialogue, recently announced a UN Office of Drugs and Crime, ASEAN and China have started a trilateral dialogue. So that might be another opportunity to get engaged. And then just would second also that while it is quite clear that China has a disproportionate influence in the region and they're sort of flexing those muscles in the response, I think some of this, what we're seeing, and particularly, and this is not an element that we've talked much about here, but that this is an industry that accounts conservatively for 40% of the GDP of these three countries, running into the limits of what any bilateral engagement looking at a traditional state-to-state sort of relationship is likely to yield. And so that's why, again, these global responses, alternative creative mechanisms to try to inject accountability into these environments is really key. And that does probably look beyond what China is going to be able to do on their own.
Say that I was recently in Dubai and saw compounds in Dubai that we know to be targeting South Americans. And if you have seen Jim Browning, he does videos about this, and they are now employing models and having them speak in different languages than they once did. I mean, what we're seeing is that that they are, that certainly their geographic footprint is growing and their target areas are growing. And I just came from the RSA conference in San Francisco about cybersecurity, and I saw some great demos on what can be done with deep fakes. And I saw this man sitting there who does not speak Russian or Chinese or Italian give a speech in beautifully in all those languages. It's scary. And then what he did is he took his CEO and took known video from his CEO and then had his CEO doing the same thing. So. We're seeing this more and more. We know that this is a sophisticated enemy who is at the top of its game, and is we can only imagine how bad it's going to get. And so when I think about this, I think about the scams and the fraud, but I think if we're only thinking about scams and fraud, we're not thinking big enough about the damage that these organized operations can do. And that while today they're doing pig butchering and job scams and all these efforts to take our money, what happens next year when they start turning off our water and our transportation and our, I think that we have every reason to be very concerned about their abilities and what they will pivot to next.
They're scary. I see one more question here. You raised your hand several times, so I want to make sure we get the mic to you.
Thank you. My question is about the connection between cryptocurrency and these scams. I know that several of the exchanges, FTX and some other, you know, the price of a lot of these currencies have gone down in the last couple of years. But what is the sort of current linkages between these centers and cryptocurrencies as of 2024? Is it still as strong as it was a couple of years ago, or has that changed? Thank you.
I think all three of you could answer that question. So we want to start with Erin and work our way back.
Sure, absolutely. This is very cryptocurrency dependent. They're using cryptocurrency, particularly in the scams against the victims in the romance scam situation, where they are showing these victims a very affluent lifestyle that they are living, while at the same time gaining their trust. So that ultimately when our victim says, hey, how are you able to afford all this? They say, oh, I'm doing it through cryptocurrency. They are deliberately using an element that people are not familiar with, and that then they can have the opportunity to show them inflated results as a result of putting their money into it. They are able to control a belief system about the growth of this that they couldn't do otherwise. They couldn't, unless they were making up stocks or something. It's just, the cryptocurrency also enables them to move things quickly, cheaply, and pseudo-anonymously. For the most part, it's very difficult for us to identify who is ultimately holding that crypto before they move it out. So crypto is a major part of this, and as a matter of fact, what's happening now is that there is a rise in the value of Bitcoin, which is making it all the more all the more desirable for people to believe that now they really could get rich because they're seeing noise about another bull run for crypto. So yes, that's definitely part of it.
Yeah, and I would say certainly though we have seen trafficking victims report shifts in the way that the scripts are being used, dependent on what the market's doing. That's absolutely at play. But at the end of the day, most of these are still at their core crypto related investment scams. At least when you're talking about Shazupan pig butchering, we're talking about crypto investments. And crypto also plays, as Aaron alluded, a major role in the money laundering aspect of this. It helps the criminal groups evade using the money just exits normal financial systems, and it never re-enters fiat currency form until it gets to one of these highly problematic financial systems that have demonstrated strategic vulnerabilities like Cambodia, Laos, Myanmar. So that's...
I think the other pattern that we've seen some continuity around is the involvement of the criminal players behind all of this activity and continuing to invest in more new technological innovations in kind of the broader fintech space. So, you know, you've continued to see a lot of these fly-by-night types of, online exchanges that can go between fiat currencies and crypto. I mean, they were in Singapore a few years ago, kind of operating between Singapore and other countries in mainland Southeast Asia. You've now seen a lot of that development pivot and go to Dubai. But in terms of the types of platforms, you know, looking at building out new sorts of online tools to be able to move money, that's something that I think, you know, through this study process, we were able to identify quite a few of some of the same actors, but involved in developing new forms of fintech based in a broader set of jurisdictions. And then I think certainly the other thing that continues to be a major problem is just with these outright fraudulent platforms for trading crypto, which are pretty key to the overall scams. I mean, those continue to be available on major places like Google Play, for example, which recently took down a few of these things. But there are so many of them that are out there now that I think it's really critical to look at, you know, how do you hold companies that are hosting these things, making these things available, accountable, getting them more involved in trying to address some of this.
And one last point about that is that they're deliberately putting their money into crypto exchanges that are not good allies with the United States. So a lot of crypto deliberately operates outside the United States, so not to be monitored and subject to U.S. regulations. And when they put them into Huobi, which is arguably Chinese state-owned, there's no way we're going to get any information or any type of ability to recover that cryptocurrency.
Unfortunately, we are at time. So my sincere apologies to the online audience. We didn't get to your questions, and to those in the room whose questions were not answered. I hope you'll join us afterwards. We have some coffee, tea, and water out in the lobby there, and you can ask your questions of the experts then. But I'd like to ask you all to join me in thanking Deputy Assistant Secretary Yoder, our panelists, and our study group for this report, and to you all for being here. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this event. If you'd like to listen to more events or explore our other podcasts, visit usip.org/podcasts.